When you catch a virus, it hijacks your cells to make copies of itself, enough so it's got a shot at spreading beyond your body to some other hapless victim where the whole process starts over again. Best case scenario, that virus shows up and gets bounced by your immune system so you can shake it off before you even feel sick, let alone spread the misery to anybody else. But what about bad ideas? Can we do anything to keep our brains resistant to viral information that turns out to be illogical, toxic, or dangerous? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest says bad ideas are parasites. Not like parasites, not metaphorical parasites, but actual parasites that feed off our cognitive resources with no regard for the ways that they leave us damaged and dysfunctional. But this is where philosophy can come to the rescue if we know how to use it. Andy Norman is director of the Humanism Initiative at Carnegie Mellon University. His book is called Mental Immunity: Infectious Ideas, Mind Parasites, and the Search for a Better Way to Think. Andy, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's nice to be here.
I have to say the idea that bad ideas are parasites that infect our minds is disquieting, to say the very least. How did you start thinking about the ways our thinking can be taken over by false or toxic beliefs?
Yeah, it is a kind of a creepy idea and hard to get used to at first. So the backstory is that I've been studying how minds screen ideas for about 30 years. And trying to figure out what really works to screen out the bad ones and let in the good ones. And I've come to the conclusion that what I call the standard model, the idea that conscious critical thinking is what allows some of us to screen out the bad ones, and the lack of critical thinking being the thing that leaves other people susceptible, that idea is wrong in almost every particular. And a major obstacle to human progress. And the alternative, I think, is to actually get comfortable with this idea that ideas can infect our minds and spread at our expense, but that we can build up our mind's immune systems so that we become more resistant, not just to false ideas, but to ideas that don't serve humanity well.
What counts, Andy, as a bad idea? And how can we tell the difference between truly disordered conclusions and things that, you know, cause reasonable disagreements over interpretation?
Yeah, that's the big million-dollar question at the heart of this whole project, for sure. So it turns out that philosophers have been advocating for a certain attitude towards bad ideas for thousands of years. And the idea is this. Whether an idea is good or bad is not just a matter of opinion. It's not merely subjective, because ideas actually have properties. They have logical properties and they have causal properties. And we can examine those properties carefully and in as neutral and fair-minded a way as we can. We can get better and better at spotting the downsides, the problematic features of ideas. And we can help each other, we can help draw each other's attention to those problematic features so that we're less susceptible to them. Of course, this practice has gotten a lot of philosophers into a lot of trouble over going all the way back to Socrates in ancient Greece.
Well, you remind us that philosophers are actually professional myth busters. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So nobody likes to have their ideas challenged or shown to be wrong. And so our pride gets enlisted in the service of protecting the beliefs we have. A philosopher at Yale called Dan Kahan has a term for this. He calls it identity protective cognition. Over time, we start to identify with our core beliefs, and then we become actively resistant to changing those beliefs, even when the evidence for changing those beliefs is extremely good. So one solution is to hold our beliefs loosely and recognize that they're likely to outlive their usefulness at some point, at which point we need to let go of them.
So the pathogens in question here are ideologies. Why are ideologies so good at breaching our defenses in the way that random facts or assertions of fact on their own are not?
Part of it is that ideologies are like bundles of ideas that are especially resistant to revision, in part because they help to support a person's sense of self, a person's identity, but also because they tell a story about who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. And everybody clings to an ideology. Everybody who is infected with an ideology manages to classify themselves as one of the good guys, or if not everybody, just about everybody. And once a set of ideas assures you that you're on the side of the angels, it becomes especially hard to part with it. But of course, that also can make us closed-minded and stubbornly partisan in ways that can, for example, divide a nation.
And it's not just us, right? These ideologies then kind of compel us to spread them in the same way that a virus compels us to spread it by making us cough and sneeze.
Yeah. So again, this takes us back to the sort of the creepy idea at the beginning that bad ideas are essentially mind parasites. If you think about it in the following way, bad ideas require a host. You can't have ideas floating around in nothingness. They require something to host them. Ideas can induce their hosts to spread them to other minds. And of course, ideas don't always serve us well. There are such things as bad ideas. So it seems to me that bad ideas are properly classified as mind parasites because they check all the boxes. They meet all the criteria of the kind of thing that can parasitize us and thrive at our expense. And again, the solution is to recognize, and by the way, there's about 60 years of research now that supports the little known conclusion that minds actually do in fact have immune systems that can function either well or poorly, and that we can learn, that we can study these immune systems with the new science, I call it cognitive immunology, learn how to make our minds' immune systems work better, and the result should do far more to protect our minds than standard critical thinking instruction.
All right, we're going to talk about cognitive immunology in just a moment, but first I want to play a cut of InfoWars host and conspiracy theorist Alex Jones.
The official story of Sandy Hook has more holes in it than Swiss cheese.
My gut tells me the White House, people controlling the government's, were involved in this. So don't ever think the globalists that have hijacked this country wouldn't stage something like this. They kill little kids all day, every day. And it's not our government, it's the globalist. I mean, they're doing it. They're doing it. They're staging it.
Okay, Alex Jones, Andy Norman, is an extreme example. But it would seem that most people would be motivated not to catch and spread bad ideas because they are harmful by definition. But you remind us here that an idea can benefit its host and harm others.
Yeah, that's right. So Alex Jones is getting rich spewing this garbage, right? So it benefits him to spread false and destructive ideas. I mean, parents of Sandy Hook parents have been receiving death threats in the mail because of the kind of bile that Alex Jones spreads. For one thing, Alex Jones gives his listeners a sense that they're in on a big secret. It makes people feel special to know that they see behind the curtain and grasp the big conspiracy. He speaks his falsehoods with great confidence, and people tend to trust people who project confidence. And the kind of disdain that Alex Jones heaps upon mainstream media is actually corrosive of mental immune systems. He's actually subverting the mental functioning of his listeners and hijacking their minds.
He also gets to this set of properties by which bad ideas can be beneficial in the short term and harmful in the long term. So people who listen to his explanation of what happened at Sandy Hook for the moment have the sense that they can understand why this terrible thing happened, even if the why is still disturbing. But of course, in the long term, he's spreading a lot of toxic beliefs and actually not getting to the truth of things.
Yeah, and I think that's nicely put. To truly assess an idea properly, you have to think about not just its short-term benefits, but also its long-term costs. And you have to think about its impact on others, not just impact on yourself. Otherwise, you become a selfish thinker. And so responsible thinking has to examine and test ideas on several dimensions that disinformation profiteers like Alex Jones simply don't.
All right. So please continue. I'm sorry.
I was at an end there. I think Alex Jones doesn't care to assess ideas because he is so busy getting rich off of peddling irresponsible ones.
In our society, even in the sort of public forum, and this is true of other societies as well, we kind of assume that beliefs and assumptions inspired by religious faith are sacrosanct. And I think one example of this is the persecution of LGBTQ people by some religious people who believe God disapproves of queer relationships, right? Are there ways to challenge those beliefs that folks have without making people more protective of them because they are part of their faith and by extension their identity?
Well, all the evidence shows that it's very hard to talk somebody out of cherished beliefs that are central to their identity. And as somebody, you can't just waltz in as somebody they don't trust and drop a few arguments and expect them to change their minds. People are swayed about fundamental things by their friends, by the people they know well, by people they trust. And so we actually have to practice the art of having dialogue with people we disagree with and practicing the art of building trust even across ideological divides. I've had the privilege of actually leading difficult conversations between people who have different views about ethics and religion and politics practically every day for about 25 years. And when you do that on a regular basis, you start to understand the subtle power of dialogue, but it has to, of course, be conducted in the right spirit. And it takes all parties to a dialogue have to bring that spirit to the table, or the dialogue isn't going to transform us in the way that it has real potential to.
We know from history that efforts to force people to believe things that society believes are necessary or a government believes are necessary, those almost always backfire, right? So we need to find other ways to help people reassess incorrect or harmful beliefs. How did Socrates go about that?
Yeah, so I'm a huge fan. So Socrates, of course, was a Greek philosopher who wandered the streets of Athens questioning people's core beliefs in a kind of in a process that we today call the Socratic method. So Socrates would ask questions, and mostly clarifying questions, to help people see what they were really saying. And I argue in the book that the Socratic method is one of the most powerful mind inoculants ever invented. If you learn the Socratic method, you can begin applying it to your own beliefs and to the new information you come across and become far better at spotting the ideas that have problematic features. In the book, I take this Socratic method and actually enhance it in certain ways and argue that the result is comparable in some ways to a vaccine, that we can actually vaccinate minds. No needles involved here, right? Just a learning a simple process of how to ask the right questions can do a great deal to protect us from the wrong ideas.
The Socratic method can get pretty combative pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Are there ways to help frame these conversations as a kind of a shared pursuit of truth and knowledge rather than one wise person attempting to enlighten another by poking holes in what they believe?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Chris. So the moment conversation becomes combative, it begins to erode certainly the trust upon which real belief change can happen. But it also turns out to trigger our mind's immune systems in the same. So you know how our body's immune system can go on hyper alert and overreact to, say, pollen, right? It's called an allergic reaction. In exactly the same way, our minds can overreact to information it perceives as threatening and generate questions and doubts about things that aren't genuinely doubtful, aren't genuinely questionable. So just as there are cognitive immune deficiencies, there are also autoimmune disorders of the mind. There are mental immune disorders that involve hyperactive questioning, hyperactive doubt. And you can see that on display in some of the conspiracy thinking that rejects the mainstream media as all corrupt, for example.
But I wonder if you could explain for us that what you call the house guest heuristic.
Sure. So we tend to get, I mentioned before, we tend to get attached to our beliefs. And if you get into the habit of treating your core beliefs as like heirloom furniture, you're likely to become defensive anytime somebody raises a question that threatens or appears to be capable of destabilizing that belief. But that very fear can prevent us from opening our minds and learning. So the alternative is to view our own beliefs as temporary house guests that might help us in one way or another, help us understand the world, help us navigate the world, help us be better people, whatever. But beliefs almost always have limits in terms of what they can do for us. And every single belief, it makes sense to think of all of our beliefs as at best imperfect models that can help us to one or another degree, but that will eventually reach their limits and become dysfunctional. So if you regard your beliefs as house guests that might wear out their welcome, it can help induce the kind of mental flexibility that will allow you to become a lifetime learner.
Sure, and I guess it's a lot less alarming to realize you no longer believe something you once held dear.
Right. And it turns out that when you have to let go of or relinquish a core belief, the result is typically not catastrophic. Usually you find, oh, I'm okay after all. That wasn't so bad. I tweak the belief in this way or revise it in this way, and life goes on. In fact, I can now understand things a little bit better. So questions and doubts and challenges to our beliefs aren't things to be feared. They're things to be welcomed.
We live in a time where a lot of people associate being tolerant with assuming that everyone has a right to their own opinion, regardless of the specious facts that might play into that opinion. Why does that worry you?
Yeah. So the idea that everyone has a right to their opinion passes as almost orthodoxy these days. People on the left, people on the right, religious people, secular people, almost everybody thinks that that's a good idea. But it turns out that that idea feeds a kind of sense of entitlement. And it helps to excuse irresponsible believing, right? If you can turn around and just say, you know, go away with your questions, I'm entitled to believe what I like, then you have a get out of jail free card, essentially, that allows you to evade your cognitive responsibilities. The fact is we have cognitive responsibilities as well as rights, and we've been emphasizing our cognitive rights to the exclusion of our cognitive responsibilities for a long, long time. And that's one of the reasons our culture is immune compromised right now, and we're seeing epidemics of nonsense spread so rapidly.
So, Andy, we know people have wondered for an incredibly long time, what should we believe? You prefer C.S. Peirce's question, by what method should we fix our beliefs? What is the difference?
So part of the difference is that when you embrace, so the scientific method is a way of investigating what's really true and weeding out bad ideas. When people are trained to follow that method, they become less susceptible to, for example, divisive ideologies or conspiracy thinking. But you don't have to have a degree. You don't need to have a white lab coat to derive the same benefits for yourself. All you need to do is embrace the process of idea testing and welcome the chance to adjust your confidence levels, your beliefs, based on what you learn in the process. So each and every one of us can do an enormous amount to refine our thinking about important subjects by simply asking questions, getting together with friends, bouncing our ideas off of people, and whittling away at them when it turns out they don't quite survive scrutiny. I think this process can turn us all into wiser versions of ourselves, and it would make us all, and it's much more important to identify with the process of honest inquiry than to any particular outcome of inquiry. If you get wedded to any particular answers, then your mind will overreact to challenges to those answers. Far better to identify with the process of honest inquiry or investigation and let the chips fall where they may.
Critical thinkers try to form and refine beliefs according to reason, which is a good thing in the aggregate, but it forces us to also ask how we distinguish a good reason from a flimsy one. What advice do you have?
I'm going to answer a neighboring question because I think it might be more helpful for everyone. Each of us brings certain standards, maybe implicit standards, to bear when we try to decide whether to accept or reject a new idea. A standard that has a great deal of currency is the idea that if you can come up with a good reason for something, then it's okay to believe it. Turns out that is dead wrong. It's not enough to look at the reasons for. You also always have to examine the reasons against. And a good way to do that is to take a look at all of the questions you can think to ask about the idea and track down whether there are decent answers to them. Because if there aren't, the idea is probably not worth hanging on to. So I recommend letting go of the idea that a good reason is enough to make an idea reasonable and replacing it with the idea that ability to withstand questioning is the true measure of reasonable belief.
You write that science as a strategy for belief regulation is quasi-socialistic. And when you say that, you are not criticizing science as a strategy for belief regulation. So what do you mean?
Yeah. So science crowdsources the search for truth. Scientists understand that no one person is wise enough to answer these deep questions about quantum physics and relativity and, you know, the chemical makeup of the world. They understand that many people working in tandem and testing each other's ideas with a distributed population of idea testers, that's far better than any sort of centralized top-down approach to regulating our beliefs. So I actually argue that although we're loath to talk about belief regulation, we actually do need to do a better job of regulating belief, but that doesn't mean we have to appoint thought police and centralized authorities. Instead, we can join in the joyful process of collaborative idea testing and become part of a worldwide community of idea testers. In effect, we can all become amateur scientists and do a far better job of helping humanity become wiser.
If our mental immunity is not functioning as it should, how can that get in the way of our moral growth?
Yeah, so a lot of people talk. So I mentioned earlier the idea that everyone is entitled to their opinion. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the Democratic senator, once said, everyone is entitled to their opinion, but we're not entitled to our own facts. Mm. Many people cite that quote with approval. And it channels the idea that facts, that we are accountable to evidence when we're talking about facts, but when we're talking about our values, it's suddenly anything goes. Well, that idea is not serving us well. The idea that values are fundamentally subjective or arbitrary or just whatever you want is allowing a lot of irresponsible thinking to flourish. And as I argue in an op-ed I'm working on right now, a few bad ideas about right and wrong can drag a cartload of facts into the ditch. We need to learn how to think responsibly about good and bad, right and wrong, just as we need to think responsibly about the facts. And until we get good at both, wisdom is going to escape us.
Is one reason always factually or morally superior to any others? Can we always figure out the best truth?
I think we should regard every determination we make as provisional, in the sense that no conclusion should ever be placed beyond further scrutiny. But that doesn't mean we can't achieve sort of temporary closure and resolution of important questions. There's a kind of closure that can be had without resorting to closed-mindedness, as I argue in the book. In fact, there's a very deep philosophical quandary about how can we possibly achieve cognitive closure about anything unless we're closed-minded about something. And I argue that that argument has functioned to excuse dogmatism for thousands of years. And in fact, it dragged Western civilization into the Dark Ages. We need to overcome that argument. And the way to do that is to work out exactly how you achieve a responsible kind of ideational closure. And that's what the final chapters of the book are about.
Is it possible to be protected from infectious ideas and arrive at something close to truth if we're not curious?
I'm going to say no to that one. It seems to me curiosity is an essential part of the mind's a healthy mental immune system. So perhaps incuriosity is one of the things that can compromise a mind's immune system. Yeah, I like that, Chris.
And do we need to test our own beliefs first and be sort of sure that our own oxygen mask is on before adjusting someone else's? Do we need to test our own beliefs before we challenge those of other people we think are wrong? Or can we successfully engage in both of these kinds of idea testing simultaneously?
Yeah, I think the right way to help humanity develop its immunity to bad ideas is to first go to the trouble of developing our own immunity, right? In the same way that you would put a oxygen mask on yourself first on an airplane before helping your children. That's the recommended course anyway. In the same way, I think we need to actually do the hard work of trying to become a little bit wiser ourselves, and then we can try through the power of our example to inspire others to follow suit. That's far better than fault finding.
Is there such a thing as herd immunity to bad ideas?
I think there is. And in fact, I think it's terribly important for humanity's future that we work out how to induce herd immunity to, for example, divisive ideologies, or herd immunity to conspiracy thinking. In the internet-connected age, we become so susceptible to weird forms of ideation. And until we can actually develop our collective herd immunity to it, I think epidemics of unreason are going to tear societies apart. And I think this is one of the most important problems of our time, which is why I'm working to bring together researchers, cognitive immunology researchers from all over the world, so we can actually plot out an infodemic preparedness plan, a way to help inoculate humanity against the worst forms of cognitive contagion.
Andy Norman is director of the Humanism Initiative at Carnegie Mellon University and author of Mental Immunity, Infectious Ideas, Mind Parasites, and the Search for a Better Way to Think. Andy, this has been really interesting. Thanks very much for making time for us.
It's been a real pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Mia Estrada, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.